If you listen to only one radio show this summer, listen to this one. I hear it's quite good. It's, you know, those guys who do that thing. They talk about that bourbon with the big ass.
Hello again and welcome to the Tweed Renegades. This is Plato Sandylands. And joining me again on the line from the People's Democratic Republic of Australia is the TRBC's political commentator, Milton Johnson, a.k.a. Lord Bromley.
Yes, greetings.
And you're joining us for another 30 minutes of paleo-conservative political analysis and whatever other rubbish we choose to talk about. And I have a hunch this week, Milton, that we might just be discussing the Gillard government, so stay tuned for that. But I wanted to start with something that we began talking about last week. It's a word that I have a bit of an aversion to, having spent several years in the corporate world. But I wanted to talk about the paradigm, the left-right paradigm. We began talking about this last week, about how very often conservative commentators, who you might expect to be more objective on a certain issue, will very often just fall into the trap of believing what all the other conservative commentators are saying without really giving that much in-depth analysis to the issue. And this struck me when I was reading back through a lot of conservative blogs, looking into their analysis of the Occupy Wall Street movement. Now, they were very critical of the movement, and I have no problem with that at all, because I have very little sympathy for that movement. But just because you criticize one movement doesn't mean that you have to immediately give your full support to the antithesis of that movement. And that's what a lot of political commentators did. I saw quite a few conservative bloggers just reblogging propaganda from the banking industry. We've got one example here. Yeah, this is on Bloomberg. So a site run by Mr. Bloomberg is worth $22 billion. The headline is, "Bankers Join Billionaires to Debunk Imbecile Attack on Top 1%. And conservatives are just reblogging this. They're basically giving the banksters a free run to, you know, say whatever they want. Listen to the tone of this. I mean, it's one of those articles that's pretty hard to disagree with because of the way they've framed it. Jamie Dimon, the highest paid chief executive officer among the heads of the six biggest US banks, turned a question at an investors' conference in New York this month into an occasion to defend wealth. "Acting like everyone who's been successful is bad, and because you're rich, you're bad. I don't understand it," the JP Morgan Chase & Co. CEO told an audience member who asked about hostility towards bankers. "Sometimes there's a bad apple, yet we denigrate the whole." Oh, they really are a sweet bunch, the bankers, aren't they? They're a bunch of teddy bears.
That's just creating a straw man. They're saying, well, he's saying that their argument consists in, well, just because you're wealthy, you're bad. Well, that's not the argument. It's because you're a crook that you're bad. It's because you're creating money out of nothing and creating tax havens, transferring money overseas, basically creating off-the-book transactions for whatever the result that you want to manipulate, draining the real economy of its wealth and creating a parasitical economy like a cancer. That's the objection that they have to these banksters, not that they're creating wealth. In fact, they're not creating wealth, they're destroying it.
Indeed.
They're creating their own fake money, their own fake wealth. So, you know, even when he's objecting to what Occupy Wall Street are apparently saying, he's full of lies.
Yeah. Well, that's it. But the problem is, too, that Occupy Wall Street, I mean, I don't think he was specifically just responding to them, but it was in the wake of what was going on at the time. The problem is they don't even know what they're objecting to half the time. They don't have any official statement or any official agenda. It's basically just a collective of unshaven, unwashed hippies protesting against people for having money. And I mean, in a way, he's actually kind of right about what they stand for.
But in fact, I had a bit of a conversation with one, and I said, well, look, I have to disagree with your assertion that it's to do with, you know, it's to do with capitalism. The problem is there's not enough capitalism, and it's more the corporatism where you've got the big companies and the government ganging up. But he just said, oh, well, we'll have to agree to disagree. He didn't even bother to engage me. So I'm like, but you guys, you know, they think that socialism is the answer, and socialism is even worse.
And again, we have this same thing that happens all the time. We've got this split down the middle of issues that are too complicated to be divided into only two parties. So we've been given these two alternatives for our financial system. One of them is socialism and the other is unbridled capitalism. And we've been told to choose between one or the other. it's not that simple that you can fix all the world's problems just with one ideological system or the other.
Yeah, well, that's right. And in fact, their idea of capitalism is not even the way capitalism is supposed to work. They're assuming that capitalism is where bankers gather together against the government, screw over everyone else, and then act like parasites and crowd out the real wealth. That's not capitalism. So these conservatives who defend the bankers because they think they're defending capitalism,
yeah,
they're not.
And then, of course, when it all goes awry for them, the banks are the first ones asking for a handout, which is a socialist thing. So where the heck are these people coming from?
Well, that's right. That's the banksters. Privatise the profits and socialise the losses.
Yes.
That's not capitalism. In fact, that's an even more unjust form of socialism than the one that that has traditionally been advocated. Because, you know, I can understand the theory about stealing from the rich and giving to the poor, but to steal from the poor to give to the rich.
Exactly. And they love to invoke the American dream and all that sort of nonsense, like if you work hard, you can make it big. But these people don't even work hard. They just generate money out of nothing.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's right. The American dream, it's like, oh, well, you know, they say success and, you know, if you work hard, you can make money, which is true. But the real money is to be made by those who don't work hard and are simply parasitical.
Yeah, they're actually undermining the American dream because of the concentration of wealth in such a small number of hands. It's making it harder and harder for the small person to make it big.
Remember when Iceland owed all this money? They said that Iceland owed all this money, but it was the banksters who owed the money, and they wanted to get Icelandic people to pay to bail out the bankers, basically, to stop the banks from collapsing. And the
how long ago was this?
2009, I think, or 2010. Anyway, there were like riots in Iceland, and it was only a very small population. There were a few hundred thousand or whatever, and they like threw rocks in Parliament. They went like basically that people just wouldn't cop it, and so what they did was not only did they not only refused to go along with it, but they arrested executives in Iceland of the banks.
Oh, wow, amazing. What's going on over there? We've got to have to move there.
I know. Well, that's just bloody awesome. That's why I said to the Greeks, I tweeted the Greeks, I'm like, don't cop it. Unfortunately, they did. But at the time when they had a vote, I said, well, you don't have to vote for fake austerity. You don't have to vote for that. You don't owe the money, kind of thing. Don't cop it. Iceland didn't. These people belong in prison.
Who would have thought that Icelandic people would have been the most politically vocal people?
I know. Yes. Well,
funny thing is, though, the Greeks have shown themselves to be politically vocal when it comes to austerity.
Mm.
Like, no, don't take away our money.
Yeah, that's right. But then they voted for the bloody... they voted for those parties anyway because...
Well, they haven't got much choice, have they? But they had protests in the street against the austerity measures.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Greeks have... Okay, I know that this is a bankster thing, but the Greeks also have a problem with their own culture as well, in that they do have a very socialist, lazy culture, unfortunately, which is totally different to the German culture.
Exactly. They're like, you'd have like the Greeks on one end, the Germans on the other, and then Australia's kind of in the middle turning towards the Greek end.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that makes sense. But so the Greeks, some of it is the Greek culture, but what's actually happened is that the economy has been hijacked. What the Greeks should do is simply... go back to the drachma and be able to trade their way out of their problems. If they have a low currency, then that will help their export and they'll be able to at least get some industry happening. At the moment, the Greeks don't have really an industry that they can use. So they're basically just, they're allowing themselves to be raped by the IMF and the, or the Troika as they call it, the IMF, the EU and the World Bank, dictating their conditions that they're going to impose on the Greek people.
That's right, and then we have bloody Wayne Swan. How much did he donate to Europe?
Oh, 500 million, or was it more than that? It might have been more than that.
I thought it was in the billions, wasn't it?
Now, I found the figure, $7 billion for the IMF.
Wow, that's disgusting.
Sorry, $7 billion US to the IMF.
From Australia.
There you go.
That is just outrageous. Can you imagine, I reckon even 10 years ago, if they'd done something like that, it would have just been... a front page outrage. Now it's lost in the noise of Labor's profligacy and Labor's stuff ups. Really?
Oh yeah. I mean, that's right. I mean, if you make each episode worse than the rest, then they don't remember the second worst one, etc. It's disgusting what they're doing to this country.
That's it.
No, the 500 million was the one that that we gave to developing countries to help them adapt to the climate.
$500 million.
Yes, $500 million stolen from Australian people to help people adapt to climate. Basically, money that's been siphoned from Australian workers to support African dictators and their wives' shopping sprees.
Wait, do you know which countries it was that were the recipients of that?
No. I don't, because I haven't really investigated it. But
it'd be interesting to see whether they're the sort of countries that would actually put up some kind of front of actually spending it on climate, or whether they'd just fritter it away.
I think they'd be those island countries that are like, oh, you know, help me out, you know, our island will be submerged.
It's not, when you say stolen from Australian workers, I mean, it will be eventually, but it's not at the moment because we don't have the money. What the hell are we doing spending this money we don't have?
Well, what's stolen from our economy is basically debt that's been put up. We have to pay for the interest. I mean, we're going to have to pay for it somehow. We're borrowing
money. Well, that's what I'm saying. It's stolen from workers eventually, but at the moment it's not stolen from us because we don't even have it. They're spending this money they just don't have.
Why is the Australian government borrowing money for taxpayers to pay back, to go back to third world countries? I mean, why are they siphoning money? Or why are they borrowing money? Not to spend on us, but to spend on overseas, you know, to adapt to climate. How dare they? It's treasonous.
I know. I mean, it's like I was saying earlier, it's just so ridiculous when you think about it in these terms. We're spending $10 billion a year in the hopes that sometime in the next century, the world's temperature might decline by 0.00001 of a degree or something. It's like, can you imagine when the history of the world comes to get written? People will think this whole thing was a hoax.
Oh, yes.
They just won't know what to make about it. I mean, they'll think the whole record of what happened was a hoax because they just won't be able to believe that people were conned by this ridiculous thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what a joke. And how long has it taken for people to wake up? I mean, sure, there's everyone's skeptical now, but only because they've been financially raped.
I noticed even on an ABC article about climate change, there were a lot of comments saying, what a load of rubbish.
Yeah, well, there you go.
That's on an ABC article.
Yeah, well, if the ABC audience is skeptical, you can only imagine what the public thinks.
I guess there's only so much propaganda that people can take. I mean, the ABC, someone did a survey about news stories and regarding climate change, and they noticed that in the last couple of years, the media reporting of climate change has declined by about 60%, and yet on the ABC and Fairfax, it's actually increased by about 80%.
That's right. I remember that. Unbelievable.
And so you get to the point where it says things like, they're talking about now, like, oh, climate change could cause killer hybrid sharks, and climate change is responsible for more suicides, and climate change is responsible for more health issues that will cost the health system all this money.
Oh.
And crikey.
That's just overkill. I mean, they've lost so much credibility. They've tried to overplay their hand so much that they're just looking like idiots now. And their response is just to up the idiocy even more. So, and yet, oh, Christians are the ones who are crazy and irrational.
Yes. Well, I mean, climate change has been declared by, it was a British court that declared a belief in man-made climate change can be considered a religion under the Religion Act.
Well, at least they're honest. That is their religion. And a pretty crap religion at that, too. Oh,
yes.
We're all doomed. Oh, that's a great religion. Yeah, oh, climate. Oh,
Mother Earth. Oh. Let's all dance around a cauldron barefoot.
I wish they bloody would, but the problem is these people are always the ones who are telling other people to do things that they're not doing themselves.
That's right.
They're hypocrites.
What about Tim Flannery's waterfront house?
Oh, yes, I know. Oh, it's just crook. And that Al Gore, that arsehole, $1 billion he's making out of this whole carbon emissions thing. It's a good way to give the globalists money, but why do people put up with it? Why do people listen to it?
And, of course, then there's the Tim Flannery Centre that's cost us $6 million and has been delayed countless times and gone over budget due to rainfall. Never mind that Tim Flannery a few years ago was saying the drought was going to be a perpetual thing. You know, we'd never see normal rainfall again.
I can't believe they've got the chutzpah to call it the Tim Flannery Centre. To name it after a failed bureaucrat leech who takes money off people to make false predictions.
And here's an example of the ABC's reporting. There's an article here. They said climate change skepticism could wipe out rural towns. A new report is warning hundreds of inland Australian towns could cease to exist by 2050 if locals do not adapt to climate change. The report studied 1,600 bush towns and found the ones with low education rates are least likely to make the decisions needed to adapt to a hotter future. Okay, so they're making the assumption here that if you have a lower education rate, therefore you are stupid, therefore you're less likely to adapt to climate change. Maybe it's that you haven't been indoctrinated with politically correct crap as much.
Yes, how can you believe that? It's like, oh, well, you know, dumb country hicks, they're dumbasses and they're not going to survive climate change.
That's what they want to say. They're just trying to, they need a report to make it legitimate. You can't just come out and say that if you're on the ABC, but you can find somebody else who's written a report and spin it in that direction.
All right, so the ABC hates salt of the earth country people. Okay, well, that's very nice. Maybe we should stop paying their taxes, or maybe they should stop paying their taxes.
And there was some other thing I was going to read, but I can't find it. It was about some ABC asshole was interviewing some climate, actually he wasn't a climate professor, but he was a professor of, I think, geology. And he wrote some climate skeptical book, and the ABC person was just absolutely ripping into him. He had no arguments against his position. All he was doing was trying to undermine his credibility by having some puerile argument with him about the definition of asbestos. And like three quarters of the whole interview was trying to argue what asbestos was.
I remember that.
Or whether this particular substance was asbestos. And he never did he actually challenge the guy's assumptions or challenge the guy's position. It was just all about trying to undermine his credibility. And yet they have the chutzpah to say that climate skeptics are the people who avoid the facts and just attack and denigrate.
Yeah. But the worst, the what's even more objectionable is the fact that we have to pay for their prejudice. And we have to pay for their political prejudices. The other thing here is that I'm thinking of giving Andrew Bolt a call tomorrow when he has his show with Steve Price at 8 o'clock in Sydney. Because I said here, I said that the ABC has often been accused of being culturally left-leaning despite the ABC's charter, which mandates impartiality. Maurice Newman's assertion that there should never be an ABC view, remember that? The ABC is accused by conservatives of displaying an overt left bias. One way to gauge this is to look at who the ABC follows on its less formal Twitter accounts. This will provide a clue into the political affiliations of ABC staffers. I've conducted a survey on some ABC accounts, and news radio is probably the most telling. It's supposed to be a straight news station, right? So it follows mostly journalists. However, Mike Stutchbury is very much left-winger, with whom I've had arguments. MCHLFRCS, or something, whose profile says he's into lefty politics. That's what he says on his profile. Bob Brown. And there's no conservative people or politicians that ABC News Radio follow. I suggest that they don't follow any conservatives because they don't want to hear from us.
Well, they shouldn't be following any politicians unless it's an even spread.
But that's what I'm suggesting. I'm going to make the argument that the ABC betrays its own political affiliations and its own cultural bias in who they follow. We've got here, for instance, ABC, Lee Sales, one of the female hosts of the 7:30 report. Mostly journalists, which I've assumed charitably to have no political affiliation, but where you've got outright political bias, you've got here two of them are right or conservative. One of them's a Liberal politician. 14 of them are left or green. And 5 of them are Labor politicians.
Wow.
So I'm just saying that lets you know, despite their protestations to the contrary, that they definitely do have a left-wing bias.
Well, that's an interesting way of quantifying their bias. I'm surprised they'd be that transparent.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. I know. And in fact, when I saw it, just took a casual look, I'm like, wow, they're following Bob Brown on news radio, and that's the only politician they're following.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, so I'm going to raise that on Andrew Bolt's program. I hope that causes a bit of a stir.
It seems like they're just so overtly biased, and they have been for so long, that they just don't care anymore because they know they can get away with it.
Yeah.
If they really want to continue this lefty loving they've got, then privatise the thing and it can end up like Fairfax.
They'll discover market forces the hard way.
And I was going to say about the ABC too, they have this transparent ability to claim that they're unbiased because they always consider the other side of the argument, or often anyway, not in their interviews, but on their online articles, which are the easiest things to pinpoint for surveys, they'll often consider the other side of the argument. Like, say, in that climate story, they talk about Mount Gambier resident Leon Ashby disagrees. Mr. Ashby is a spokesman for the No Carbon Tax Climate Skeptics Party, which believes that while the climate is changing, it is only minor and not due to humans. Blah, 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 blah. Then they give his opinion for a bit. But, I mean, it's still clear where their slant is in the article, because you can just always tell what the slant is from the headline. The headline in this article is climate change skepticism could wipe out rural towns.
And yeah, I know.
I mean, it's pretty obvious where they're coming from. And, of course, you know who gets the first and last word.
Yeah, well, exactly. How's that? Oh, climate change could wipe out rural towns. It's like, oh, okay, yes. And then, like, buried in one of the paragraphs there. However, and then they present this guy's argument very well, but then it's buried there somewhere.
And it's just it's the whole framing of issues. Because
just the fact
that they're even raising this nonsense shows that they've got a left bias. Because a conservative publication wouldn't even worry about some stupid survey that warns that hundreds of inland Australian towns would cease to exist by 2050 if locals did not adapt to climate change. I mean, it's just not important because it's rubbish.
I bet you that didn't make it in The Australian.
I've seen some ridiculous reports over the years. I remember my favourite one was smaller families are more eco-friendly. Yeah, it was targeting two things at once. It was targeting the whole let's worship Mother Nature thing, and it was targeting the whole overpopulation myth at the same time. Here's a question for you, Milton. Would Mark Latham have made a better Prime Minister than Rudd or Gillard? I know you bought the Latham diaries, so maybe we'll be hearing a few of his thoughts throughout the next few weeks. What was the other book you bought by Latham?
Was that The Conga Line of Suckholes?
Yeah, that was it.
But it wasn't all quotes from him. He was actually the editor of the book, compiling a whole bunch of different quotes from people like Churchill and whatnot.
You could have just made a book of quotes just out of him and Paul Keating.
Yeah, he could have. Now, I think even Mark Latham would be a better leader than Julie Gillard. Julie Gillard's just the worst.
But then he might have brought in gay marriage. I mean, he might have actually had the guts to do a few things, and that might not have been good things.
That's true. He strikes me as being a very kind of a... Well, he always, he grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney, affiliates himself more with the working class rather than Julie Gillard, who tends to have a middle-class lawyer background kind of thing, childless. I think Latham would identify more with families than Julie Gillard would.
Probably. And, I mean, I remember one of the reasons I didn't like Latham was because of what an aggressive sociopath he was. And, I mean, he broke some reporter's camera or something. But then when you think about it, I mean, he's probably less sociopathic than Kevin Rudd.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, also, I think these days you have to be a sociopath to be the leader of the Labor Party. So it's like choose your best sociopath.
I don't really know what to make of Latham, because it's easy to agree with the things that an ex-politician says, because they always talk a lot of sense when they're not in office or when they're not in opposition. I think one of Latham's problems is that he had that straight-talking reputation before he came to the leadership of the Labor Party. And maybe that's what people expected, and yet when he was actually in the position, he became a bit of a suckhole himself. One minute he was calling John Howard an arse-licker for his position towards the US, and he was calling George Bush the most dangerous leader on earth or something like that. And the next minute he was appearing at a press conference with the Australian and American flags side by side. And his campaign was pretty much just spin and slogans. Whereas I think with Kevin Rudd, nobody really knew what he stood for to begin with. He was just a fresh face, looked pretty friendly, and he was pretending to be John Howard. And after 11 years of Howard, a lot of people were up for change. But it wasn't just the Australian people that quickly wised up to him. His staff also very quickly got sick of him, and he had some kind of unprecedented resignation rate in his office of something like one person every 30 days.
Yeah, because he was an arsehole.
Yeah. And I love that two-faced Kevin, you know. It's like in public he's got this kind, meek image. And
that's
someone
right.
Actually described it as being like, they described it to when you're in one of those relationships where all your friends and family think your significant other is like a real lovely person and they all love them. And when you break up with them, they're like, oh, why did you dump them? They were so nice. But only you know what an arsehole they were in private. They describe that as being, that's the way the cabinet feels.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. But that's the way people describe sociopaths, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's right. But then again, people have obviously got a short memory, because Rudd was absolutely plummeting in the popularity stakes. I mean, he was almost as unpopular as Gillard is now before Gillard took over. That's why she succeeded in stabbing him in the back. It would be interesting, actually, to take a look at the news poll from around the time before before Gillard became leader.
Yeah. All right, let's have a look. This was May 2010, It was 49-51. Labor was 49, Coalition was 51, two-party preferred. And then 14th to 16th of May, it was 50-50. Then the 28th to the 30th of May, it was 49-51 in favour of Labor. So for 3 weeks there in May, it was roughly 50-50. Now, that was before Gillard took over, right? So that was Kevin Rudd at his most unpopular.
Wow, because I remember him being really unpopular. I think it was when that sailor bird, the Jessica Watson, came back. There was some ceremony for her in Sydney. And then she said, Rudd called her a hero. And then she got up and said, look, I'd have to disagree with the Prime Minister. And everybody started cheering. And that was a sign for me that he just lost it. And I think also there was some rugby match or something where he appeared on a screen and everybody just started booing.
That's right.
And I know it's only a couple of incidents, but it just seemed to me to be the point where I figured he's just lost us now.
Yep.
Maybe 50-50 was looked a lot more unpopular to us because Labor had such a honeymoon.
Yeah, it was relative unpopularity, I think.
Yeah, but it was a big and quick decline. I think that was probably what was so shocking about it. But when you think about that compared to Gillard, it's actually nothing now. I mean, that would be great figures for the Labor Party. That'd almost be electable.
Yeah, it would be. So there you go. That's 50-50. So that's Kevin Rudd. Now, I guess that's why the Labor Party is saying, look, I know Kevin Rudd's an arsehole, but hey, I wouldn't mind retaining my seat. Let's give him another go.
Yeah, well, you'd be crazy not to, wouldn't you? I mean, they've got no hope whatsoever, and I think it's going
to... But nothing to lose.
Yeah, it's going to have to happen. The only thing they've got to lose is they'd have to spend another 3 years under a Rudd-led government. And not many of them would want to do that. I think some of them might actually prefer opposition even.
Yeah, well, I think what they want to do is win their seats and then possibly deal with it later. Try and turf Kevin Rudd out later, perhaps.
Mm, possibly.
Because it gives them 3 years.
Yeah.
They got 3 years of power.
That's true. That's probably what it'll be. I really can't imagine that Rudd's not going to get back in before the election. And if he does, it'll be a week and then there'll be an election called.
Yeah. I mean, Gillard's just hanging around like a bad smell. I'm surprised to the extent which she's still going. I mean, really. Every time you hear her speak, I'm just thinking, look, I know a lot of people are incredibly stupid, but I don't know that anyone actually is inspired by what she has to say. Yes, we will move forward together.
And she gets basic words wrong.
Yeah, and we are us, and hyperbole, I won't engage in your hyperbole, we are us, we are the Labor Party with Labor values, and...
I'm actually just looking at Kevin Rudd's Twitter page, and I've noticed he's using emoticon, like smileys in his tweets to people, so he's really putting it on, isn't he?
He's turning on the charm.
Yes, and I can see he's got 1,132,785 followers. So that would be, like, considering Australia's got, like, 22 million people, that's, like, what, 1/120th or something of the Australian population. They expect us to believe 1/120th of the Australian population follows Kevin Rudd. Take out the children, it's, like, 1/10th or something. 1 out of every 10 adults or something in Australia follows Kevin Rudd on Twitter. Actually, take out the elderly as well. There's probably even more than that. Are they expecting us to believe that?
No, well, that's where the controversy is, because they discovered that Kevin Rudd was basically just using Twitter robots to try and boost his follower robots and boost his numbers.
I wonder how many people are legitimately interested in the crap he has to talk about.
Well, I'm interested in politics. I haven't followed him. I don't think I've followed him anyway.
I've got to love the emoticons, though. You know what? It's a real manipulative thing, because whenever somebody uses an emoticon online, it always looks so much friendlier than you could ever convey with a real smile in real life.
Yes. There it is, federal member for Griffith, proud father of 3 great kids with my wife Terry.
he's hamming that up too, in opposition to Julia.
Proud grandfather of Josephine, born and raised in country Queensland. He's the salt of the earth, Kevin Rudd.
He's really a saint. I think instead of like K Rudd MP as his Twitter name, maybe he should just do like Saint K Rudd.
Or maybe he should be provocative and do K Rudd PM.
I love it too how like a couple of weeks ago, he was playing down the whole idea that he's going to challenge again. And he's like, no, look, I'm over that. No, it's not going to happen. And then so obviously he doesn't want to raise it again. So he got Therese to go to the media and raise it again.
That's the way. goodness. Delegation.
Twin Renegade.
That's it for another week. Thanks again for listening. This is Plato Sandylands. He was Milton Johnson. If you'd like to get in contact with us, you can email mail@tweedrenegades.com or tweet directly to Milton @LordBromley. Thanks again for listening, and you'll hear us again soon.
Catch you later.